I'll have some clam chowder followed by beefsteak on rye, pumpkin pie, whipped cream and coffee. I want a green salad on the side. Don't forget the French fried pizza pie, garlic and anchovy.
This is Eating It in the Hudson Valley. I'm Phyllis Segura. Today I'm speaking with Gary Allen, a food writer and food historian. Or do you prefer a culinary historian?
Food writers, broad enough.
Okay. And we're talking about some of the history of the foodways in the Hudson Valley and about some of the things people ate in the past. First, let me tell you a bit about Gary. He's contributed articles to several reference books about food, including the Resource Guide for Food Writers, Culinary Biographies, and the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America. He's topped that off with three published books, The Herbalist in the Kitchen, another about global history of sausages, and the most recent, Can It, The Pleasures of Preserving Food. A book about sauces titled Après Escoffier, Sauces Reconsidered, is forthcoming. He is also a regular contributor to Roll magazine about creative living in the Hudson Valley. There's more, but I'll let him speak for himself. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you.
Did I get any of that right?
Pretty close. The CV is way too long to list in this amount of time.
Yes,
now.
But I hit the major notes.
Yeah, here. Pretty much, yes.
Good. Gary and I have been talking about apples, cream cheese, donuts, amongst other things. I'll try to prod him to speak to us about some of the food history in the Hudson Valley. Is it really the Dutch who set the tone here? How much are we beholden to them? Coleslaw, pancakes, apple pancakes with bacon and gouda, donuts? Tell us all.
Well, you know, we keep thinking about like apple pie as being quintessentially American. The first apple pies were from the Dutch, and they were here in the 17th century. There were five different ones at least.
Five different?
Apple pies.
Kinds of apple pies.
Yeah.
Oh, that reminds me of the discussions I'm having with people about what latkes really are.
Oh, it's endless.
So I'm not, yeah. I mean, everybody makes it differently, but what were the differences?
Oh, they varied according to what kind of toppings they had, whether they were made with fresh apples, dried apples, because they use them all through the year.
Uh-huh.
So many variations.
Oh. Did you make any of them? Are the recipes around? Or just the
recipes are around. There's a woman who lives farther down the Hudson, Peter Rose, who's Dutch, and she has put out cookbooks based on all of these old recipes.
Yeah.
She's translated the original Dutch cookbooks. The first cookbook in the United States, actually, was The Sensible Cook that she brought here.
Uh-huh.
She translated. Excuse me. She didn't
translate
it. She's not that old.
It was the first cookbook in the United States.
The first cookbook in the United States was actually Dutch.
Uh-huh. Language was it written in?
In Dutch.
Oh, in Dutch. And so she translated it to English.
Yeah, Peter Rose translated it into English.
Do you remember the year that approximately?
Oh, it was the most popular book in Holland in the 17th century.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, in Holland, yeah.
And it covered all aspects of life, but The Sensible Cook was one part of it. It was a big book.
It wasn't about American cooking, it was about Dutch cooking, and then it came here?
It came here, yes.
And then people started to cook from it, you think?
Absolutely.
Yes?
Absolutely, yes.
Oh.
There was a woman in Albany in the 18th century that was Dutch also, mm-hmm. who also built on all these recipes. So it's a long tradition here.
Give me an example of like what they might have cooked.
Oh, well, the thing that has probably the biggest impact on the way we eat today?
Yes.
Cookies and donuts.
The donut story.
Donuts. Donuts yes. It's fried food time, yes.
Don't you have the story of how it got its hole?
The hole is actually a relatively recent invention.
Oh.
And the reason is when they switched to different kinds of batters and they dropped them into the hot oil, the middle wouldn't cook.
Right.
So they cut the hole out of the middle so the oil could heat all sides of it.
And now we eat just the hole.
Yes, we do. Actually, the holes that we sell now, the little donut holes, are very close to what the Dutch would have sold originally. They call them oilekoeks or oilekakes. And it's actually very close to the donut holes we eat now.
Ah. Reminds me of, I don't know how to pronounce it, abelskivers?
I couldn't tell you that.
You don't know what those are? You need a special pan to make those.
Oh, yes.
And then you put it in the little circles, and you put some in, and sometimes you put
little,
jelly
the
in.
Right, the little dimples in the metal plate.
And those are rounds, and they're stuffed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went on a craze of trying to make those one time.
Yeah, they're like miniature jelly donuts. Baked, but
more,
not fried.
It's more pancakey.
Yeah.
A little bit different, but close. But it's great fun to have the circles, but they're tedious to make, because basically you can only make about six at a time.
Right.
So they're nice anyway, but they weren't. They might have been making Abelskivers.
Right.
Abelskivers.
Yes.
So was it mostly Dutch or the British?
The British came in the 18th century.
Right.
Right. The first cookbook in the United States was actually a British cookbook, the first one printed in the United States, and it was a reprint of an English cookbook.
Uh-huh.
The first American cookbook was until just before the Revolution. And it was Amelia Simmons' book. And that was the first one to mention cornbread and things like that.
Yeah.
Because nobody made that before.
Right. What else? Do you remember?
Okay.
I know.
Too much.
Too much.
too much.
Well, cornbread, that's interesting, because we attribute that to the South mostly, don't we?
Now, yes.
Now.
Yeah, because corn grew so well down there.
Uh-huh. So how did they get corn going, I wonder?
Well, corn originally came from South America and Mexico.
Right.
But it's been part of the American Indians. They had the three sisters, corn, beans, and squash.
Yeah.
Those are their primary foods.
Yeah.
So the first colonial people learned it from the Indians.
And it was hybridized.
Oh, of course, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the original corn is called teosinte, which is a tiny seed about the size of your thumb.
Uh-huh.
The whole corn cob.
Oh.
And it doesn't grow wild anymore anywhere. All the corn in the world has been hybridized from that.
Oh, and now it's another story altogether.
Too many stories.
Oh, my. How about telling us about cream cheese?
Cream cheese.
Yes.
Oh.
Cream
cheese, we need to go back to the Civil War.
Oh, really?
Yes, because the Catskills were originally covered with hemlock forest. They were dark, dark blue, black. That's why they call the Blue Hills, right? When the Civil War came, the hemlocks were all harvested for their bark because the bark was used for tanning leather, which was a primary military material.
Right.
So all the hemlocks in the Catskills pretty much were cut down.
What would Socrates say?
you'll have to ask them. The only places you find native hemlocks anymore are in narrow little cloves that were too inconvenient to harvest.
Uh-huh.
But all the hardwoods that we see now are all second growth. When they started growing, the land was not good for farming. It was too rocky, but it was good for grazing cattle. So the dairy industry grew like crazy. Unfortunately, they didn't have refrigeration yet, so they couldn't really market the milk. So they started making cheeses, which lasted longer. At the same time, in New York City, people had been importing cheeses, German cheeses like Liptauer and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But they were very expensive, so they were looking for cheaper replacements. So somebody down in the town near Goshen brought a cheesemaker from the old world over here to get instructions. And while he was handing over the instructions, somebody else was sitting outside the window listening. He took those recipes home.
And how do we know that?
There are websites from that area that talk about all of this, the history of all of this. But in any case, he took the recipe home, but mistakenly tripled the amount of cream in it. And it made this wonderful cheese. At the time, Philadelphia was the most prestigious town in the country. So when you wanted to market something, you named it Philadelphia. It's like now we would name things Florence or Florentine to give them a little economic buzz.
Right.
Philadelphia was the thing then. So the cheese came to be known as Philadelphia cream cheese.
And it had nothing to do with Philadelphia.
Nope. It was all made in the Catskills.
Fantastic. Fantastic. And by the way, let's go to schmear, the word schmear, because cream cheese and schmear kind of go together.
Of course.
Now, I dispute your definition of schmear. I won't get into your spelling, but that's okay. I'll let you get away with that one. It's not a thick slathering of cream cheese, but a small slathering that doesn't cover the entire piece of bread or bagel. The word is a direct borrow from the Yiddish and meant the schmear of cheese, but modern usage is anything that can be spread. Anything, you know, like if you order a schmear around here, I've practically gotten an entire package of cream cheese dumped on a bialy, and it's a very sorry situation. It enables one to have a temporary loss of speech due to have too much in your mouth. It's rather like the type of plating that's become popular. You know, when the chef smears a sauce on a plate to look like a brushstroke, it's more than that. But I found an article as recent as August of this year that asked the question, how much is a smear? And they say, and then we're going to read it, so far it hasn't been resolved, and the police have been brought in by the Cream Cheese Council of the Hamptons. I quote, citing recent unrest regarding cream cheese policies at local bagel shops, the Cream Cheese Council of the Hamptons was called into special session over the weekend. At issue was how much cream cheese constitutes a schmear and how much bagel shops can charge for an extra schmear if a customer requests one. In recent weeks, the police have been forced to intervene in numerous disputes over the amount of cream cheese bagel shops are providing per bagel and have reportedly found themselves confused by the often hazy regulations surrounding the subject. The police department spokesman said, some places you get more cream cheese than you know what to do with. Other places you wonder where it all went. There's no consistency out there. The police requested guidance from the Cream Cheese Council, and a clarification is expected soon.
I suspect the U.S. government has not yet come up with a precise definition of schmear.
No, it's
just a guess.
It's Solomonic, you know. We have to look for the days when wisdom was something one could depend upon in a leader.
Right. Yeah, I think any time the cheese outweighs the bagel, it's a mistake.
Oh, yes. It's then called a glob. I'm speaking here with Gary Allen when I'm not speaking, and I'm going to play a little klezmer music for a moment here called Bagel with Cream Cheese. That should soothe the cream cheese lovers. Let's move on to apples.
Okay.
How do they figure in the Hudson Valley? Did Peter Stuyvesant actually plant the first apple tree, and what happened to it? I know you have this story.
Well, the story is that he brought the first apple tree to the New World, and that it lasted so long that it was well into the 19th century when it was actually knocked down by a train. Otherwise, it would still be bearing fruit. Whether this is true or not, it's hard to say. There is, in the food history business, we call this fake lore. There's a lot of it.
As Gracie Allen might say, why did he plant it on the railroad track?
Yeah, Gracie. No relation, by the way.
Do you know what kind of tree it was?
Impossible to know. I'm sure it's none of the varieties we have today, because all of those were really bred specifically for marketing purposes.
Well, lately there's been a resurgence of growing some of the old types of apples.
That can only work if you can find the tree that had them and get a cutting from it.
Well, Montgomery Place, by the way, I did try to contact lots of orchards around, and they all closed. So I think that they all went to Florida or someplace because they don't answer their phones, they don't answer their email, and they don't answer.
Right.
So I wasn't able to find out the answer to the question about, but there were lists, like on the Montgomery Place website. There's a huge list. They plant over 70 kinds of varieties of apple. Right. I'm going to put that up on the Eating It in the Hudson Valley Facebook page, so if anybody's interested in reading. And there are descriptions of the apples as well.
Right. Yeah, the old varieties, that there were hundreds of old varieties. You can only grow them if you have a cutting from the original tree.
Right.
Because apples do not reproduce from seed identically. Every apple seed is going to grow into some other kind of apple altogether.
Yes.
So without cuttings, you can't reproduce an apple.
So much for the Johnny Appleseed story.
Well, he was only really planting them for liquor purposes.
Liquor? Yeah. You mean like
hard cider? Yeah, that was the primary use of them. So they really didn't care what kind of apples came out of those seeds. Just as long as it had sugar that could ferment.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, somebody must have the cuttings because they are putting in all kinds of varieties.
Well, they have lots
now.
Of varieties, but they may be modern varieties still.
Yeah. I remember them saying that they were, you know, going back and doing it.
You'll have to find an old tree.
Confirmation of that. Yeah. But how did New York State become so good for apples?
It's perfect climate.
The climate.
It's perfect temperature, amount of moisture.
Like Normandy?
Yeah.
But there's other places in the country that grow.
Pacific Northwest.
Ah.
Yeah. Washington grows a lot of them. The biggest producer of apples in the world now is China. Sad to say.
Well, there's the Asian apple, but it's not the same
thing. Not the same, no. But a lot of the apples that you'll get in the off-season are either from South America or they've been in cold storage for a long time, which they get kind of mealy eventually.
Yeah.
Or they're from China. They're from all over.
Well, I've been getting a lot of the local apples, really. I go up to Samuscott. There's one kind that I really love. It has a brown skin. I forget the name of it, but it's crisp and lovely.
Yeah, there were a lot of brown skin apples that were very popular in the past, but because people expect them to be bright red and smooth and shiny, they don't sell. So a lot of people stop growing them.
Right.
You know, if you have the smallest amount of brown, like a little brown scabby spot called rust, on an apple, people won't buy it, which is insane.
Yes.
It has nothing to do with the flavor or keeping properties.
No, and there's a lot of food waste because of that. But I'm going to be talking about that on the food report later, about what's happening and what's being suggested for all the food waste. Is there anything that you would love to talk about, like your new book?
My new book, by new book, you mean the last one out or the next one?
We're always going to the next one, right?
The next one is a book on sauces from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm plugging away at it pretty furiously right now because I have to turn it in March. So it's cultural and scientific. What I did is, the old days, Escoffier broke down his mother sauces and daughter sauces, and he had five mother sauces. All but one of which were thickened with flour or starch.
Mm-hmm.
We don't eat that kind of sauce anymore, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have hundreds of other sauces. We have sauces from all over the world that we eat every day. So I thought,
but aren't they marked more with a lot of butter?
The original French sauces were, yes.
Yeah.
But we eat sauces from China, from Vietnam, from Korea, from South America, from Mexico, all the time.
Yes.
Right? None of those fit into the pattern that Escoffier came up with.
That's true.
I came up with a new hierarchy that's based on the physical properties of the sauces. So there are solutions, suspensions, emulsions, gels, composites of all of those things combined. You know, for instance, what we would call tartar sauce is an emulsion. That's mayonnaise, but has suspended in it chopped pickles or relish, something like that. So it's actually a composite sauce.
Okay.
And so on. So once you look at sauces structurally, you can understand how they fit together, how they vary from place to place. Like you might have the exact same sauce in 20 different countries or cultures that have slight variations on them, but they all structurally the same.
Give me a for instance.
For instance, okay. The oldest sauce that we know about was from ancient Rome, and it was called liquamen. It was basically fermented fish scraps.
Fish sauce, right? Yeah.
The fish sauce that we have from Southeast Asia now is almost identical to it. Mm-hmm. Right? They came up independently, but they're really the same sauce.
Okay.
In England, they've adopted some of those things. One of them they have is called anchovy essence. But the one that's more familiar is Worcestershire sauce, which has a basis of fermented anchovies in it.
Right.
So we've been building on the same kind of basic ideas for thousands of years.
Okay. There's another name for the fish sauces. I forget that. An ancient name.
Yeah, there's two names, and the other one is out of my head at the moment.
I can't remember.
It'll come back as soon as we get off the air.
And a gel?
A gel, okay. Anything that's thickened with starches are technically gels. So the most familiar thing would be gravy, right? Or the sauce in gumbos, which is thickened with roux, which is a starch mixed with oil and browned.
Right.
Right. So all of those starch-thickened sauces are all gels. Another one that's not starch-thickened would be the kind of sauces that people make to serve with game, where you take a bit of red currant jelly and melt it into the pan juices.
Yes.
So that's a pectin gel.
Uh-huh.
Right? So there's a lot of different variations. And a lot of thin sauces that we think of as not being starch thickened do have modified food starch or something like that, you know, to give them the right viscosity that you want.
Mouthfeel.
Right.
We call it, But I always look at sauces as liquid. When you're eating...
It's broader than that.
Well, it's broader than that, but you need to have the liquid element in things that you're cooking. Mm. When people say, oh, everything is dry, it's because they haven't added any liquid. I mean, sometimes you can make a sauce just by adding water.
Sure.
You get a sauce. And that always makes things taste better. Mm-hmm. When you have this liquid element, as humans, we like that. I think even dogs and cats like it.
Sure.
It's, you know, they don't like that dry food stuff at all. You know, unless it's...
Well, some of the sauces actually originated from the cooking liquid. And we have recipes that go back to ancient Mesopotamia.
Right.
Where the meats were actually stewed in liquids. And that liquid became the sauce that was served with it. But sauces, it's even more general than that. I mean, think of all the commercial sauces. You know, ketchup and things like that we use. Mustard is a sauce. Mayonnaise is a sauce.
Right.
All the countless hot sauces that are out there.
Indeed.
Most of those are suspensions. They're tiny, tiny ground-up chilies suspended usually in vinegar of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a thousand. Basically, a sauce is something of a fluid nature that adds flavor and aesthetic properties to a food. Nowadays, the modern thing of serving smokes in the table. You know about those?
Smokes? No.
Oh, they'll bring to the table this covered dish.
Yeah.
And inside it is this smoke made either from cooking it or from burning something else. And what you do is you take the plate to you, you lift off the cloche at the last second, and that smoke comes up and flavors the meal for you. Because most of this flavors are through your nose anyway, right?
Yes.
Most of what we know about taste is actually through our nose.
Yes.
So the smoke is actually a sauce. It's affecting the aesthetic properties of the food, and you're getting that aroma, that quality.
How do they keep the sauce,
It's like a covered, like a little bell jar.
Yeah,
it's brought to the table.
Yes, okay, but what are they burning inside of it?
Oh, it could be a spice. It could be something from cooking the food itself that they trap some of the fumes.
They trap it in, and what's the delivery system?
It brings it in a plate with like a bell jar over it. So there's a little cloud in this covered dish.
Uh-huh.
And they put the dish up in front of you, open it, and the cloud escapes. And you
where
inhale
have
it.
You experienced this?
I have not.
You haven't?
These are restaurants that are way out of my price range.
Oh, I see. But you're seeing that as a sauce.
It is effectively a salt. A gas is a fluid.
All right, I'll let you get away with that. But I don't know about that.
Obviously, I'm not going to address that in detail in the book, but it does fit the category. It does fit the category.
It fits the category as a sauce. Well, then how do you define sauce?
Basically what you said. It's basically some fluid that either comes from the food or is designed to go with the food.
But how is smoke a fluid?
Because all gases are fluids.
Oh, gases are fluids.
I didn't say liquid. I said fluid.
Yes, you didn't. That's like Gore Vidal saying it's not it's natural but not normal.
It's a tough room.
You'll have to look that one up. So is the point of the book is that classic sauces, the way we think of them, are dead?
Well, they're just a small part of a much larger spectrum. You know, in classic French cooking, you had the mother sauces and the daughter sauces. For instance, you could take a bechamel sauce and add cheese to it, it becomes Mornay,
right.
And so on and so on and so on. Right. Now we combine sauces. I mean, look at the barbecue sauce tradition in this country.
Yes.
Most of them are made from groups of subsidiary sauces. They'll have mustard, they'll have ketchup, they'll have Worcestershire, they'll have tomato sauce, they'll have all kinds of things. They'll have vinegar.
Yes.
They'll have mustard. Yeah.
Yes.
And they're put together in different ways and all over the country. There are hundreds and hundreds of sub-variants of barbecue sauce.
Wouldn't you just call them concoctions then?
Well, every dish you ever made is a concoction.
Concoction.
That's too general.
Yeah, all right. It's too general. Does barbecue sauce have a history?
Yes. Yes. The barbecue actually comes from the name barbacoa, which was the kind of grid that people cooked meats on over a fire in the Caribbean.
Uh-huh.
So when the Spanish first came there, they saw people cooking meat that way. In order to keep the meat from drying out on that grill, they'd keep wiping it down with some liquid, a sop.
Uh-huh.
Nowadays it's vinegar, Worcestershire, all kinds of things. Usually you don't put barbecue sauce on until the very end.
Okay.
Because it has so many sugars in it, they'll burn.
Exactly.
So you don't want to do that. But all the other ingredients can be used as a sop to keep the meat moist.
Mm-hmm. Very often I'll do a dry rub first and cook it that way.
Right.
And then put the barbecue sauce on at the
sure.
very end.
Sure.
Yeah. For that sweetness. But a lot of people don't like the sweetness.
Then they should go with maybe some of the South Carolinian sauces that are based on either, depending on which part of the Carolinas, either they're based on vinegar or based on mustard. They're much tartar, and the vinegar ones are very thin and watery.
But mustard has vinegar.
Mustard has some vinegar in it, yes. But
right.
But as you head west of if you're taking I-81 down south.
Have you?
Yeah, yes, many times.
Yeah.
If you're heading east of that, you're going to be getting more of the vinegar-based kind of sauces. You head west of that, you're getting more mustard-based sauces.
Which do you prefer?
Well, I love them all.
I love them all, right.
You know, it's like saying, which one of your children do you like best?
Yes. Yeah. But what was your process? How did you figure out that, what you just told us? This side and that side of the road. How did you determine it?
From going down there and from reading up on everything I could find out about barbecue.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of it out there.
Really?
Yeah.
So you knew, like, where did you go for one type and the other? I mean, that's what you looked up.
Well, there was a great article in the New York Times magazine section, over a decade ago.
Uh-huh.
And it was about a family split. And it was the two brothers. One of them on the west side of 81 has Maurice's Barbecue. The other brother on the east side, I forgot his name,
uh-huh.
has the other style. They also are politically totally different.
Uh-huh.
Maurice is a right winger. The other brother is a left winger.
Uh-huh.
So they're, it's like the Mason-Dixon line going vertically.
Right.
Splitting the two.
Right.
Yeah.
So. And?
And which?
What was the difference in their sauces?
Oh, the Maurice's was the Western mustard-based one.
Uh-huh.
And the liberal one was the vinegar-based one.
Did that have any political consideration?
I could probably stretch and make one, but I'm not going to.
No. Oh. And where was that?
This was in the Carolinas, east and west of Interstate 81.
Okay. And did people decide which they liked better?
Of course.
Yes.
People are as determined about this as they are about how much cream cheese to put on a bagel.
Yes.
There's very strong opinions on this stuff.
Absolutely. I know. I remember that there was some place in around Fort Lee, New Jersey, where there were hot dog stands across from each other with the same, or a very similar story.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's a general rule that whoever is your closest neighbor is the one you despise the most, right? So New Yorkers hate New Jersey drivers.
Yes.
You know, I don't know if I can say this on the radio, but in Connecticut, they refer to drivers from Massachusetts as massholes. Take a look at...
we're all going to remember that, you know.
Yes, yeah, we're going to take that back.
Can't.
If you go to Israel, mm-hmm. the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Well, that's a classic case.
They're right up against each other, and they have so many things in common.
Same foods,
but the tiniest differences become major arguing points.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's the same.
Exactly. The hummus story could go on.
Hummus goes on. I have a huge section on hummus
on
in my
and
book.
On. Nobody even knows what it is anymore. Right. And the word hummus actually
just means chickpea.
Means chickpea.
That's all it means.
I know. Yeah. That's it.
The hummus that we usually have is called hummus bi tahini, which means all of our hummus has tahini.
Right. Yes. Whether it has lemon juice and it has.
The Greek
cumin
version is not called hummus.
There's a Greek version?
Yes. It's called fava. Because it's made with fava beans instead of chickpeas. But like hummus.
But these days they would call it hummus.
Well, actually, they have another hummus-like thing, but it has a different name in Greek altogether.
But mostly it's a puree.
Yeah, they're purees of
which you could also call a sauce.
Of course. It's a dipping sauce.
Well,
people dip their bread in it.
The
Middle East has thousands of dipping sauces.
Yeah.
You know, yogurt is a big component of them.
Uh-huh.
The pulses of various kinds are big components of them. Oils of all kinds are big components of them. Yeah, it's immense topic.
You grind it up.
Yeah.
It makes everything taste better for some reason.
Yeah, well, the smaller a particle is, the easier it is for it to get to your taste buds.
Ah, well, that's what haute cuisine is. I mean, it's a matter of straining the sauces over and over again that actually makes it haute.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually that was late 15th century.
Uh-huh.
Tyrell was the first one to start straining the sauces, which, you know, they were making sauces thickened with starches and things before that. They usually used bread or flour, but it was always lumpy and thick. And he's the one who started straining it through a tammy, a sieve, a fine sieve.
Right.
And that all of a sudden raise sauces to a much higher plane, much more elegant.
Exactly. Yeah. All the little bits and pieces are strained out of it. Yeah, people don't generally know that. I want to talk about cravings a little bit.
You came to the right person.
Yes? What kind of things do you crave?
I crave things with hot spices in them.
Uh-huh.
I love them.
With hot spices?
Yes. I'm half Texan, so it's genetic.
So all the hot sauces.
I have many, many hot sauces.
So do you cook that way? What's your
My wife doesn't really like hot sauces, so I tend to tone it down for her and then add more myself at the table.
Uh-huh. How hot do you get?
Pretty hot.
Yes. Yeah. I'm going to play something for everyone now that's about craving also. We have if you remember, Orson Welles did a film called Mr. Arcadin, and in that film is a character actor called Akim Tamarov. And Akim Tamarov in this film, they want to kill him. They want to kill everybody in it. It's a film that took place. It was after The Third Man. It wasn't all that successful, but you can find it on YouTube and watch the whole thing. I'm just going to play the audio track of Akim Tamarov asking what he wants for his last meal. Enjoy this.
Just now thought of what
it was. Get it out of here, quick.
You said I couldn't have anything.
Well, of course you can't.
Anything in the world, you said that. For 14 years I've been dreaming of this. Dreaming in jail, that's all you could do.
Well, what is it?
A goose liver.
Did you say a goose liver?
Fish and hot. With mashed potatoes and apples and onions.
Merry Christmas!
A goose liver on Christmas Eve? And my usual stock? Never!
Leave me alone or I quit!
Well, it's no use, Herr George. The hot goose liver, that's the thing with the one-day warning.
Very nice. I'll think of something. Thank you.
If I don't get that goose liver, I'm going home.
Well, how about a nice big cut of roast beef? Or maybe a hot stuffed turkey?
Goose liver.
But look! Arcadin!
Arcadin Shmadina!
Didn't anyone recognize me?
Are you sure?
Don't say nothing. Hey,
Hey.
Hey, come in at me. Get back!
Will you keep the door locked? We registered in the hotel under false names, but you can't tell. They may have traced us.
I'll give you an hour.
Okay.
We ain't back by that time.
I'll be back.
Fresh.
Fresh and hot.
With mashed potatoes and apples and
onions. You're lucky me.
Hey, mister! Hey! If you don't unlock the door, I'll yell for help! 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 Help!
Okay, you win. The door's unlocked. But if you don't behave yourself, there'll be no goose liver. You understand?
I'll give you an hour.
Hey, Mac, could you fix me up with a goose liver?
Es tut mir leid. Wir verkaufen keine warmen Speisen. Und übrigens ist heute Weihnachten.
What are you doing now?
Shopping. Just some shopping.
Entschuldigen Sie, mein Herr, Sie können hier nicht parken.
You'd better get in. We're blocking the road. Know me at this restaurant. They'll take care of you.
Well, why don't we go in? Or don't you want to be seen with me?
Quite a number of people have been seen with you. Bracco, for instance. Bracco was with you when he died. Sofia Dasco in Mexico. Millie was your girl.
Yeah, but...
You're a dangerous man to be seen with.
Yeah. I guess that's the way you had it planned all along.
I knew what I wanted. That's the difference between us. In this world, there are those who give and those who ask, those who do not care to give, those who do not dare to ask. You dare, but you're never quite sure what you were asking for. Now there's nothing more you could hope to beg from me, Van Straten. Not money. Certainly not my daughter. Not even your life. Give the gentleman his goose liver.
I hope you liked that. I hope you can find a goose liver. I heard that you can make goose liver ravioli. But listening to that piece reminds me of nostalgia. The nostalgia for certain foods, you know, things you haven't had, things you remember. You remember who made what and when. I have a few of those. You know, you always want to, you remember your grandmother's food, how she seasoned things. And we forget to write down the recipes often. They go away. We don't collect them.
Yeah, I have a skillet that belonged to my grandmother in Texas. And I'd had it for a long time. And then one day I decided, oh, maybe I should actually use it. And I put it on the stove and started heating up. And the smell of all the fried fish that she made for decades and decades, decades ago, came out of the skillet.
Uh-huh.
She was in the kitchen again.
Yeah.
It was astounding.
Was it a cast iron skillet?
No, it was a thin steel skillet.
Yeah. Really?
And it but the handle had like a double layer to sort of insulate it, and apparently some oils were trapped in there.
Oh, my.
And when heated up, the smell came back.
There was the ghost of...
Yeah.
That's wonderful. I'm going to give you a little bit of the food report, the November-December food report, and then we're going to go back and talk to Gary some more as we have... We'll have time about apples again. This is from The Guardian. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention study reports that only 1 in 10 Americans eat enough fruit and vegetables. Marion Nestle, who's the professor of nutrition and food studies at NYU, says that action needs to make it easier and cheaper to eat fruits and vegetables. Assuming this result of the report is close to reality, she says, it suggests the need for taking much stronger action to make it easier and cheaper to eat fruits and vegetables. The study was done by state, class, race, and gender of men, young adults, and people living in poverty. People living in poverty had the lowest rates of fruit and vegetable intake, but women weren't immune either. And I'm going to give you some percentages here. Bear with me. 15.1% women ate enough fruit. 9.2% men ate enough fruit. 11.4% wealthy ate enough vegetables. And 7% of poor ate vegetables. And then there was a disparity by the state. For instance, 2.2% of South Dakotans between the age of 18 and 30 regularly ate the recommended daily amount of vegetables. West Virginia is at the top of the least healthy and poorest, and only 5.8% ate the RDA. Only 2% of U.S. farmland is devoted to growing fruits and vegetables, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists. Farmers would need to grow almost twice as much produce for Americans to get their RDA. Instead, the food industry is with multi-million-dollar and is working to get people to eat more processed food. The researchers asked adults by calling them how often they ate beans, dark greens, orange vegetables, other vegetables, whole fruit, and juices. It's important to know what questions were asked in order to assess any study. If, for instance, people are asked if they like yellow or blue, but never asked if they like red, the study is very skewed, wouldn't you say? The site Grub Street has a listing of vegan restaurants in New York, and there are at least 16 there. The only one I know of around this area is the Garden Cafe in Woodstock. Do you know of others? Actually, some listed were vegetarian, but they could make you the vegan versions. I'd love to see more restaurants sprucing up their vegetable offerings in general. I think there'd be a call for it in Hudson, in this Hudson Valley area particularly. One thing I have seen in a few restaurants is called cauliflower wings. You laugh. It's cauliflower done up like chicken wings, fried and with the hot sauce and all. It's healthy junk food. Political reports on Representative Earl Blumenauer's alternate farm bill. He's the congressman from Oregon. You can print out a list of its highlights, and I'll put it up on the Eating It notes on the Facebook page. Michael Pollan has been in conversation with him for years, finding it at Politico's Morning Agriculture from November 17th. The topics include commodities and crop insurance, conservation, food assistance, nutrition, future of American farmers, food waste, research, extension and related matters, animal welfare, and the regional food system. It'd be nice to have comments if after you look it over and you have a chance to do that. And I'll have it up in the next couple of days. Modern Farmer reports that there are 5 most valuable crops to grow in the U.S., and they are... saffron, ginseng, lavender, goji berries, and bamboo. Take heed. There is an interest for food banks to move from mostly canned goods to fresh produce, according to a report at Medium.com. The strategy is to build regional produce cooperatives for farmers to bring surplus crops. That's where we get our ugly apples. I believe farmers can now get a fee for these donations. If I'm correct, it's up to $5,000. Groups involved are City Harvest, that distributes over 50% fresh food, and Feeding America, the nation's largest hunger relief organization. They wants to make the fresh the norm for food banks. Where's the applause meter on that? Non-perishable foods often fall towards the unhealthy end of the dietary spectrum, they say. The USDA, as it was and maybe as it is, recommends dairy, grains, proteins, and produce should be filled with perishable choices. 60 million tons of produce is thrown away yearly that is edible. I don't know where they get those figures. Meal Connect, launched by Feeding America, is meant to connect businesses wishing to donate excess food access to food banks, pantries, and food kitchens. They can get a free account and say when they'd like it to be picked up. So far, they've received enough for 278 million meals. Feeding America put up $3 million towards it, and a grant from Target for $1.3 million. Yay, Target. I'm going to put up something. I'm not going to read it, but there's been some changes in the for nursing homes, for the food in nursing homes, but you can read about that. In case you missed it, the EU voted to allow glyphosate for the next 5 years. Individual nations, however, can make their own decisions on its use. 18 voted for and 9 against. Portugal abstained. France voted against. It's been banned in Sri Lanka and El Salvador. Apparently, the EU agricultural minister didn't follow protocol in taking the vote, noted Angela Merkel, though she generally agreed with him on the matter. And then there is the case of the Arctic apple. The story from Wired magazine from September. It's the first GM apple to go on sale. I'll write out most of the story in the notes, but you can find it at Wired. It's filled with British Columbian apple grower, multinational conglomerates, and turning genes on and off, or adding new ones. Are you ready for Del Monte's pink pineapples? Or Monsanto's antioxidant-boosted tomatoes and sweeter melons? The Arctic apple, which is the enzyme has been taken out of it so that it doesn't brown. That's the whole idea. People don't like apples. Once they brown, you take a couple of bites, it turns brown, you throw it away. The Arctic apple is the brainchild of Neil Carter of, oh, I don't know how to pronounce this, Oganagan Specialty Fruits in BC. His fruits were cleared by the USDA and FDA in 2015. So he's been at it for a while. He noticed that he lost 40% of his crop. And he said, he must have said to himself, I got to do something here. And he started on this journey of finding out a way to make apples not brown, and he succeeded. That's it for this month's food report. More items in the Eating It in the Hudson Valley Facebook page notes. I haven't even read them all. Don't want to bore you. Ta-da! I hope you learned something in that. I did. Eating it. What are you laughing
at? I knew about the apple. It was very interesting, the whole process.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I have serious mixed feelings about GMO foods.
Oh.
Both pro and con. So I'm not going to come down on either side.
What's the pro? I'm curious.
What's the pro?
Yeah.
This apple, for instance.
You think it's good?
I don't know why it wouldn't be.
Why it wouldn't be? Because. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, unless you find something about it that's negative, it has no downside. It's reducing waste. People will eat the whole thing. It seems like a good deal. The downside for a lot of GMO things is all the things that are designed to work with Monsanto's Roundup, the glycophosphate.
And the dicamba.
Yeah, the main problem, I mean, yes, it increases yields, but it damages other plants, other parts of the environment.
For sure.
You know, so
watch out for those soybeans. There's non-GMO.
There's all kinds of after effects that we need to know. So that's why I say I have mixed feelings on it.
So it's
feeding a lot more of the world. This is a good thing. Whether it's harming the environment at the same time, maybe not so good.
I don't know about your last statement about feeding more of the world. We'll have to take that up at another time.
Okay.
That's a big discussion, yeah. Actually. But let's talk about, you mentioned the naturalist and Hudson Valley resident John Burroughs.
Oh, yeah. John Burroughs was, you know, in the 19th and early 20th century, he was the biggest natural history writer of all time. I mean, he outsold everybody else. He was, I don't know, we have nobody like him anymore.
What do you mean outsold?
His books outsold.
Oh, the books.
He did. I have a shelf of maybe 20 of his books, and all of them were bestsellers all the time. They were huge. He grew up in Roxbury, up in the Catskills, and at the end of his life lived in West Park, right on the Hudson. Mm-hmm. He wrote one article where he was lamenting the loss of all the kinds of apples that he knew as a child. This was 100 years ago. Mm. You know, and we've lost even more since then.
Sure.
But he would talk about how people would bury apples with layers of straw between them so they would have them all through the year. And they buried them in the order according to how fast they broke down.
Right.
So they would still have good apples when you reached the bottom of the pile.
Yeah.
This is a lost art.
Yes.
We don't have this anymore. We don't even think about it. We don't have the apples to do it with. It's just astounding to me.
It is. Well, we have a lot of apples.
We have a lot of apples, but, you know,
They're not the same.
They're mostly about what's going to keep on the shelf very well as a convenience for shippers and grocers.
Yes.
We want them to be nice and red and shiny.
Yes.
You know, the Red Delicious is a really durable, tough, beautiful apple. It doesn't taste all that good.
I don't eat it.
No.
Yeah.
No. It's not a big
deal. Even the Macintosh.
Macintoshes have more flavor, but they don't last very long. They're very soft. The advantage they have
mushy.
Is the first ones of the year. So you get an apple immediately in late August, early September.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're the first ones.
Let's give everybody, we have about 5 minutes left. How about a recipe for apples? I mean, the Dutch baby is just such a famous one. And I'm going to put that up on the site as well. That's an easy one to make, isn't it? And applesauce. Now, you make applesauce the same way I do.
It's very simple.
What Gary and I both do, if I may, is we just cut up the apple. We put a little water in the pan.
I usually use a little cider as a way of starting.
Little cider, that's fine too if you have some. Yeah. If you don't, you know, a little water. And then you wait till it gets soft, and then I put it through a food mill.
Exactly.
So that you keep the flavor from the seeds is kind of nice in there too. It's
and
a little almondy.
You get
almond-y.
A little color from the skins too.
You get a color from the skin,
pink.
And you get a little arsenic from the seeds,
oh,
which
yeah,
is very
goodness.
Nice. Yeah.
And then, arsenic? No, it's not arsenic. It's
Are you sure?
Strychnine, I think.
Strychnine?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's just as good for you.
Yeah, just a little little taste of it, you know. And set your day right.
Yeah.
And then, but you need to have a food mill.
Right.
But it's well worth it.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you are making any kind of soup or you're making a puree and you put it through the food mill, you can just cook it with all the peel and the vitamins and everything in there.
I put it up in 1-pint jars because I know 1 pint is exactly the amount I use to make an applesauce cake.
Ah.
So.
What's your website? Why don't you tell
people
that?
My website is called onthetable.us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got anything that's interesting to me. There's a huge section on French culinary terms. There's a whole hundreds and hundreds of culinary quotes. There's a link to my newsletter. I put out a newsletter that started for food writers originally that comes out every month. And it has interesting food websites, blogs, and so on. The very first blog I ever wrote about was the one that that became the movie, the book and movie, Julie and Julia.
Ah.
You know, she was the first blog that I ever wrote about a long, long time ago. But, you know, every month, you know, like the one I'm going to be coming out with in the next day or two will have, maybe 15 or 20 websites, 10 or so blogs, and so on.
That tell about what?
They're sites that are interesting about food. They're mostly
uh-huh.
informational sites,
uh-huh.
so they're very useful to food writers. But if you're interested in food generally, there's always something there.
Yes.
Yeah. The newsletter is free. You can link to it right from the website.
Yes. Yeah. Tell your website.
The website
again.
Is just called onthetable.us.
U.S.
.us.
How come you did that?
Because all the other on the tables were already taken.
Ah, okay. I think that might be it for our show.
Okay, it was fun.
Thank you so much
thank
for
you
coming.
For inviting me.
Gary is very informative and also fairly well known amongst culinary circles. So it was a real treat to have him come here today.
Oh, thanks.
And be sure to check out the Facebook page for Eating It in the Hudson Valley, where I park a lot of information. And I'm going to put up some apple recipes, too. And that's it for today. We're going to go out with a little bit of Lottie Lenya for the Alabama song, because we are thinking about Alabama today.
Oh, show us the way to the next whiskey bar.
Oh, don't ask why. Why?
Oh, we must find the next whiskey bar. Or if we don't find the next whiskey bar,
I tell you we must die. I tell you we must